I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 12th of February, Abraham Lincoln's 205th birthday. We will not ignore it. That's hour number two of our program today with the author of a fascinating book on John Hay and John Nicolay, Lincoln's secretaries. This hour of the program, I think we'll have a lot of response to this. A recent piece in the New York Times caught our attention, A Solution for Bad Teaching. It was penned by Adam Grant, a professor of management and psychology at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania. And he wrote, it's no secret that tenured professors cause problems in universities. Some choose to rest on their laurels. Others develop tunnel vision about research, inflicting misery who suffer through their classes. Despite these costs, tenure may be a necessary evil. It offers job security, intellectual freedom in exchange for low pay that other occupations require advanced degrees. But he suggests instead of abolishing tenure, what if we restructured it? We're asking researchers to teach and teachers to do research, but the relationship between teaching and research is zero, he says. So why not create three kinds of tenure? One for research only, one for teaching only, and one for research and teaching. We'll have two guests with us during the course of this hour to talk about that proposal. Professor William Tierney is co-director of the Pleas Center for Higher Education at the University of Southern California. Professor of Higher Education he is, and served as president of the Association for the Study of Higher Education. He's past president of the American Educational Research Association. Later in the hour, Peter Jeffrey will join us. He is a professor of medieval studies at the University of Notre Dame, who has been involved in many tenure decisions. Welcoming phone calls this hour, our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Leave your comments there. And we're on Twitter as well, and that's at K Dunn Show. Professor William Tierney, thank you so much for being with us.
You bet.
What do you think about this idea, three kinds of tenure?
In some respects, we have it already. One of the problems with the op-ed in general is the guy writes as if all universities function in the same way, and it's really not the case. He's a professor at Wharton, and I appreciate that's what happens at Wharton, and what happens at Wharton is similar to what happens at my university, University of Southern California, as well as Madison. But the reality is we have 4,000 post-secondary institutions in the United States, and there are an awful lot of places where teachers do most of their work is teaching, not research, and they'll be rewarded on that, and they'll get tenure largely based on that rather than research. So we really have never had a one-size-fits-all model.
We have read, and certainly parents have complained, and some students have complained, and this is a general statement, but it makes one think that it's happening at a lot of schools in the country, that they are not being taught by tenured professor teachers. They're being taught by graduate assistants, graduate students in many cases. And from what I've read, the number is fairly high that students are not getting the best teaching professors. Is that off the mark?
A touch. What the reality is, I mean, again, it depends on where we're talking about. If you're sending your son or daughter to a research university, Harvard, Stanford, Duke, USC, in some respects, in some instances, that may be the case. But if you're sending your son or daughter to a community college, for example, they're going to get the teachers who teach there. And the same is true at teaching universities. Now, we've got a different issue, and the issue right now is that there has been a dramatic increase in the last 10 years in hiring part-time faculty. But that's not a tenure problem, it's a budgetary problem. And by hiring so many part-time faculty, it's absolutely true that they're not getting the tenured research professors, but that's because there are fewer of us today than there were a decade ago.
There are fewer of what 10 years ago?
There are fewer tenured faculty today. The fastest growing group in universities in the United States are part-time, non-tenure track faculty.
Mm-hmm.
And administrators would say that they're doing that because of the budgetary crisis that we faced, especially in public institutions. But, you know, you can't have it both ways. You can't, in one sense, say, geez, we need more tenure-track faculty to teach freshman seminars and then not have them.
Right.
I mean, if we're going to do it, we got to pay for it.
Right. So you may have an absolutely brilliant part-time, non-tenured-track teacher, and students are learning wonderfully, but they're not making any money.
Yeah, absolutely. And I will agree with one part of the op-ed, and that is that there actually is very little research that says that if you're a phenomenal researcher, you're also going to be a phenomenal teacher. So, again, you know, I have my own problems. If what we're talking about is a graduate student is thrust into teaching a 300-student class, you know, just as a way to get the class out of the way, that's a bad idea. On the other hand, we may have phenomenal people who are teachers, and they're not necessarily researchers.
Mm-hmm.
But so, we can give them tenure.
So how do we make that happen? Is it a financial reason that we're not giving them tenure, or what's the problem?
Well, we've got two different problems. You know, if you look at higher education over the last decade, the fastest growing group in all of the institutions are administrators.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of us would say that we need to worry a bit about the amount of infrastructure, administrative infrastructure, that's being spent. And, you know, the thing I think that we forget sometimes as Americans in general is we sort of have a historical amnesia. At the turn of the 20th century, American higher education was a backwater. We sent our graduate students to Europe to get their doctorates. At the turn of the 21st century, American higher education is the best in the world. You know, we, as an import industry, we are doing phenomenal at the number of graduate students who want to come to our country to study. And I say that because in the 20th century, what happened? Well, one of the major things that happened is we created tenure. And we created tenure to protect academic freedom. And just as you know, some people will say, who needs academic freedom? The issue, you know, it's not that every single professor at every single university is going to call on it, but as a basic protection, it's part of the thing that's made American higher education so great.
Mm-hmm. How do universities make most of their money? Is it from the research that's being done and lucrative contracts with companies?
Yeah, not at all.
Really?
Yeah, the vast majority of our institutions are tuition dependent. And it, you know, if you're a public institution, public subsidies have dropped a lot. But either you're getting public subsidies from the state, or the student is getting, Pell grants and scholarships from the federal government and the state that pays for basic infrastructure. The number of institutions in the United States that have a significant amount of money that comes in because of research is probably less than 50. But we talk about them all the time because they're phenomenal institutions. Madison is one, right? You know, University of Southern California is another. Cal Berkeley is another. You know, these are premier research universities, but I think we fool ourselves when we think that, you know, that's the way everybody works. It's just not. You know, the private institutions are kind of an oddity in American higher education. You don't see, in general, private universities in other countries. In some places you do, but in general you don't.
Mm-hmm.
But those private universities are also some of our best universities in the world. But that, you know, that's not the way the vast majority of our institutions function.
What about what happens in classrooms at universities and colleges? Do we have a way to measure, and should we have a way to accurately measure the quality of teaching that is taking place? And I'm not even sure how you measure that, how students perform, what they think of the teacher, which in some ways can be a good measurement. Do we know that?
not enough. I mean, it's got to change. You know, one of the ways we do that is through student evaluations, and there's always a big brouhaha about the validity and reliability of student evaluations, but rightly administered, they say something and they can tell us something. But, you know, we're on the cusp of significant changes right now, largely because of technology. Because, you know, one of the interesting things, I think, is that we know in just from how people learn that not everybody learns in the same way. The way your son or daughter may, you know, learn in an optimal environment may be very different from my son or daughter.
Right.
But the reality is, up until today, it was irrelevant. Those students were in a class, and you know, if I lectured in a class or I was the sage on the stage, that's, you know, some people are going to learn one way and some people may not learn as well. But given the changes in technology and social media, I really think in the next 10 years, we're going to have a lot greater possibilities in terms of gauging how much students learn and how much a particular pedagogical strategy works or doesn't work. It's really a significant time of change. And, you know, just as an aside, if we were in a time capsule and we went back 100 years and we took some faculty member who was doing research a century ago and he or she came forward to today, that guy would be flabbergasted. He wouldn't understand how I do research, that I'm able to write papers with people from around the world, all that stuff.
Right.
But if we brought John Dewey here, John Dewey, you know, and in terms of how I teach, John Dewey wouldn't be all that surprised, because we've basically used one of two models that we used a century ago. Either we've got a small seminar where we engage in sort of Socratic dialogue with our students, or we're the sage on the stage with 300 students. That's going to change dramatically. You know, it hasn't changed that much in the last century. But right now, we're going to see significant changes.
And what will those be?
Well, I think we're going to have different types of teaching. You know, that right now, regardless of the university, kids will say, you know, I'm taking Introduction to Sociology, and it meets on Mondays from 4 to 7. And everybody knows what that means. It's a three-hour, three-unit class, and it will meet for 15 weeks. 15 times 3 is 45, and it means that there are 45 contact hours with the professor. But, you know, what I said a minute ago, imagine that your child can actually grasp the material a lot faster than my kid can. So maybe it takes your child 30 hours to do it, and maybe it takes my kid 60 hours to do it. If that's the case, then simply seat time is much less pertinent than what exists today. And again, you know, we used to think that technology was a weak second. I think that's going to change a lot. I mean, it's just the manner in which we conduct teaching. We're going to be able to do it in different modalities, which will tap into the needs of a diverse student body. Mm-hmm. It's a very exciting time to be around, but it's also, you know, change makes people nervous.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back before we go to phone calls, and we'll have them on the air in just one moment, to the New York Times article for a moment, because I'd like to hear this kind of is what he has to say, Adam Grant, about teaching. The overwhelming majority, he writes, of non-tenure track appointments are teaching only or teaching intensive. Non-tenure track faculty and graduate students teach, he writes, the majority of classes at many institutions, commonly at shockingly low rates of pay.
True. That's
all true.
Yes. And again, that's especially true today, that we are increasingly relying on non-tenure track faculty because they're cheaper. And, you know, I think that there can always be a case why we want to hire someone who is a non-tenure track faculty member. And just, you know, as a personal example, my oldest brother is a very successful international businessman who lives in New York City. He teaches a class on international business for Columbia University once a year. You know, he's the kind of guy who could care less about what he's paid. He just enjoys doing it as an aside.
Mm-hmm.
And it probably, assuming he's a good teacher, enhances the quality of that curriculum and that faculty at Columbia. But he's an aberration. You know, the norm is that we're turning out a lot of graduate students with PhDs who cannot find jobs, but they need to do something. So, you know, I live in Los Angeles, so the phrase here is freeway flyers. We've got student or got people with PhDs or degrees who really would like to have a full-time job, a full-time tenure-track position, but they can't find it. And the result is that they're teaching, you know, it could be eight classes at eight different institutions flying up and down the freeway.
Mm. And what if your specialty is research and you're really good at whatever your field is, and we tend to think of that more in terms of science, can you find a job pretty easily?
No, it's increasingly more difficult. It's not impossible, but it's increasingly more difficult. And I think you have to be more strategic in ways that I never was. You know, when I got my PhD at Stanford University a million years ago, I didn't really think about how do I do this? How do I prepare? What do I need to do for my resume and my website and all that stuff? I simply, you know, I wrote a lot and I thought a lot and I applied for jobs and I got a great job starting at Penn State. Today that is really not the norm. And in some respects, we have to realize in terms of graduate education, if you can't get jobs, then do we really need to be turning out as many PhD students as we're doing as a country when we know that graduate education is the most expensive part of the whole enterprise? You know, it's cheaper, less expensive to teach undergraduates than graduate students.
Let's go to phone calls. We'll do that momentarily. We're talking about the tenure track this hour of their program, a provocative piece in the New York Times, which we have on our website if you haven't read it yet. It's our Facebook site, actually, The Kathleen Dunn Show. It was in the Times a couple weeks ago, and it was a suggestion for a three-track kind of tenure rather than one, research only and teaching only. Our conversation, due to the interest in what our guest sees as concerns of the major universities and colleges in this country, is taking on other issues, and I guess you have to when you look at this. The author of the piece was calling for one for research and teaching, one for research only, and one for teaching only. The other issue that we have spent a lot of time on is the number of non-tenure-track faculty and graduate students who teach the majority of classes at many institutions. They're getting out of school. They have a PhD. Of course, they'd like to use all of their knowledge, and they're finding it very hard to find a job that really pays a good living. So they are adjunct faculty, non-tenure-track faculty. The compensation issue is an important issue as well. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. I'm sure as parents of people who are in college, or if you're in college yourself or graduated, it was important to you to have a terrific teacher, because terrific teachers help us learn and make it an engaging experience. So another question is, how do we make sure that that happens in our universities all over the country? To your phone calls momentarily, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to phone calls now for William Tierney, University Professor, Co-Director of the Center for Higher Education at the University of Southern California. He is past president of the American Educational Research Association and has thought a great deal about and published widely on issues of tenure, academic freedom, and performance in higher education. We start our calls with Tobias in Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi. I'm lucky enough to be a tenured faculty member at a state school here in Wisconsin myself. So I've gone through the process and I've thought about it quite a bit. And I personally think that creating three tracks of tenure doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. I mean, first of all, if I were to send my child to a university, I wouldn't want to face the decision whether my child takes a class with somebody who got tenure based on research or someone who got tenure based on teaching. I would expect, you know, for all the money that I pay, that my child is educated by somebody who is able to teach very effectively. Which brings me to the main point of what I wanted to make. And that is, when we talk about graduate schools and graduate students, if I am a graduate student or when I was a graduate student, I looked for the program that would offer me the best possible training as a researcher. But then again, if now that I'm on the other end of the, you know, the search for faculty members, if we're looking for people to hire in our department, we're looking for we're looking at institutions or people who have gone to institutions that are known for their research. But when they come to us, all of a sudden they need to be really good teachers, and there's oftentimes very little resources available in order to get these people to become very good teachers. They're told, you know, here are your classes, teach well. They are evaluated by students. They have some faculty visiting their classes. But in terms of actually turning these people into good teachers, there is very little resources available oftentimes. And I'll take this one step further. So I work with students who are going to be language teachers in the future, and I always wonder, like, the students that work with me have to go through methods classes. They have to go through classes where they're taught not just the materials that they need to be able to teach, but also how they teach it. Those methods classes are something that most people who get hired at the university level never have to go through, that mm-hmm. kind of methods training is just not available.
It's interesting, and that was one of the op-ed letters that was in response to Adam Grant's column about this. Do we need to teach people how to be good teachers, great teachers at the university level, do you think, Professor Tierney?
Yeah, I think we have to do a lot more than we're doing now. What Tobias says is absolutely correct. You know, there's a finite amount of courses and time that graduate students are in graduate school, and we want them to be experts in the content of their area. But up until now, what's happened is they've become experts, and then they go out, and what he's saying is absolutely true. You end up knowing something about what you've studied, but you don't know how to teach. And, you know, the issue is only exacerbated when you've got people who are getting their doctorates at, you know, really 100 universities, largely in the United States. And then they go out to all sorts of institutions. And the kind of students or the kind of teaching that you need to do in a community college is going to be very different than if you're teaching a research seminar at Stanford. And I'm not, you know, making a pejorative statement about community colleges. It's just you got to know your clientele, and we don't do a good enough job about that.
Thanks, Tobias, for the call. One more call, and then we'll introduce another guest and take even more phone calls. Chris in Wisconsin Dells. Hi.
Hi. I have two friends who went through the UWM system and one of them ended up in administration of an art school in another situation. But she told me that when she went to the teaching mode with her master's degree in her internship at UWM, that the extent of her supervision was giving her the key to her classroom and the time of her classes, and that was the full extent of it. And I have another friend who went into teaching in a faculty staff position who was working supposedly a 30-hour or 40-hour work week and ended up putting in 70 hours a week and ended up quitting. And I'm wondering how many people are just getting out of the system because the system is so screwed up that it's not paying people for what they're worth, and getting into these tenure-track jobs is so hard that they're just atrophying off, that good people are just atrophying off because they can't get a job and they can't make mm-hmm. a living.
Professor Tierney.
Well, it is a problem, you know, that what I said earlier is there are an awful lot of folks who want to get a job and can't get a job. On the other hand, for those of us who are full-time and working at a university, and this is certainly my own bias, but it's one of the best jobs in America. I mean, you get to work with young people, largely, who are bright, inquisitive, have ideas, and you get to work with colleagues who oftentimes are at the top of their field. You know, if I have an argument or a quibble with Mr. Grant's op-ed, it's, you know, if I had started that op-ed the way he wrote it, I would have turned it on its head. Yeah, it's absolutely true that there are some tenured professors who have fallen asleep. But the reality is, isn't that the case in any organization in the world, that in every organization, you know, tenure or not, there are going to be some folks who are no longer productive? And we need to deal with that. I don't think we need to, you know, look the other way. But having said that, the vast majority of folks that I know who are in academe are working really hard. And we may want them to work in a different manner, but that's a point of discussion. But I think to begin a conversation by saying, we got a lot of loafers out there, is just really incorrect. And there's no research that would say that.
Chris, thanks very much for your call. We're taking more phone calls, and we'll do so in a moment. 800-486-8655 is our number. First of all, let me introduce another voice to the conversation. Professor Peter Jeffrey is joining us now. Michael Grace, Professor of Medieval Studies at the University of Notre Dame. He's been involved in many tenure decisions as chair of a tenure committee and as an outside referee. He's been teaching at the college level since 1978. With experience in community colleges, state universities, Ivy League universities, and religious universities. Professor Peter Jeffrey, thank you for joining our conversation this hour.
Well, you're welcome. Thank you for having me.
So what did you make of the op-ed that we're basing our conversation on, this idea of a three-track tenure system?
Well, I think the basic idea has a lot of merit, which is that teaching skills and research skills are quite different, and you do get some people who are much stronger in one than they are in the other, while you also get some people who are good at both. So I think he was quite right about that, but it seems to me that the solution, let's just create three kinds of tenure tracks, is way too simplistic and wouldn't work without rearranging a lot of other things, because it's usually money that gets the deciding vote. And you can have things like, you can have a research tenure track for somebody, say, who's inventing things that produce patents, that produce income for the university. But in somebody, in a field like medieval studies, we don't bring in the amounts of grant money. We rarely get corporate contracts the way scientists do. And a pure research tenure track in a lot of humanistic fields just wouldn't pay for themselves. Somebody, they're not supported by tuition because they're not teaching. They're not bringing in a lot of money. And so such jobs as exist like that, they would only exist at very wealthy universities, and they'd only be for very senior people who have established their reputation. For young, newly minted PhDs, they might be brilliant, but the best they could get in terms of a research job would be a postdoc that would last a year or 3 years, and then they're back out looking for a job again.
You write in your piece in the Times that a common parental complaint you hear is, I pay high tuition for top professors and my children are taught by graduate students. You say many of the best students want to be taught by people who are on the cutting edge of knowledge. In most instances, are they, or does that vary widely from institution to institution? And how common is that complaint and valid?
Well, it certainly varies widely from institution to institution, and no question about that. And Let's see. And one thing that may not be appreciated is that teacher training is actually part of a university's mission. And while, okay, there are stories like the one we just heard where somebody was just handed the key and the room number.
Right.
I would not say that that is what always happens. Some institutions do, I think, put significant amount of effort into the teacher training for new PhDs. And that is part of the university's mission. It's sort of like the fact that to be an actual practicing doctor, after you get your MD, you have to be able to, you still have to learn how to examine patients and diagnose and so on. And so people, like my doctor recently told me he had to do 100 prostate exams before he figured out how to tell what a prostate should feel like. You know, so that's 100 people who had exams that were only about training by somebody who was not competent yet to make a determination.
Right.
And so you do have to, putting teacher trainees in front of the classroom is not a bad thing in itself. And it is part of the university's mission. And of course it should be properly handled so that they are being supervised and they are being taught how to teach. And I thought Princeton University, where I used to be, was very good at that. They had no courses that were taught solely by graduate students. There was always a regular professor who was in charge.
Mm-hmm.
No,
go ahead. You finish that. We just want to go to phone calls.
And like many universities now, they had a teaching learning center where people can go and get various kinds of training. They can have their classes videotaped so they can see what they look like. They can discuss with people how to make tests or whatever. You know, they have workshops on various kinds of things, how to teach writing.
Mm-hmm.
So the complaint that my kids are taught by graduate students, it depends on the institution. It may be true that some institutions are overly relying on graduate students, but it's not illegitimate in itself. And, of course, it's only fair to the student, the graduate student and the undergraduate students, that it's part of a well-thought-out, comprehensive teacher training program.
Let's go to more phone calls. Justin in Madison is joining us now. Hi, Justin.
Hi. I'm actually adjunct faculty here in Madison.
All right.
And I'm working to finish up my PhD. So I think your first guest really zeroed in on the problem. And I don't think it's the type of tenure offered. I think it's the fact that a lot of people aren't offered tenure. And the key assumption to that, I think, is that the assumption that grad students and adjunct faculty, of which I am both, give students a less good education. I teach on average 4 to 5 classes a year, and most tenure track faculty only teach at research tier one research institutions, teach 4. So in reality, I get as much experience as most tenure track faculty teaching. And I think the assumption we need to battle in American culture is that these adjunct faculty provide a less good education.
Mm-hmm. And what about teaching? Have you been trained at all, or would you, if you haven't, would you find it valuable to learn how master teachers teach, Justin?
Absolutely. We actually I taught at both a tier one as a grad student and at a community college. We spend more time, or at least we did at the community college I teach at now, focused on education than I did when teaching as a graduate student at the Tier 1 university. I've gotten more conferences. I'm required to take education classes. Teaching at a community college, I'm not required to take education classes at the Tier 1 university. So I've grown as a professor and an instructor being adjunct faculty more than when I was teaching at the Tier 1.
What are your job prospects when you graduate?
I am a graduate student in anthropology, and I've actually really fallen in love with community college teaching.
Great.
I just talked to my advisor the other day and told him that, and he really encouraged me, if I love teaching, to go about that. At the same time, my wife is also a grad student, so the chances of us finding a job in the same town are pretty low. So we talk about that quite a bit.
Professor Tierney, address what he had to say, what Justin said.
I would encourage Justin to go to a community college. They need good teachers, and there are more jobs because there are more
community colleges in America. I think that's a great idea. You know, one thing we need to sort of disabuse ourselves of with this discussion is the research-only tenure-track positions would probably be of interest to maybe 50, at most 100 universities in America. At almost every other institution, and earlier I said there are 4,000, this wouldn't be a point of conversation. I think that op-ed, you know, it almost makes it appear as if there's some group that decides about how are we going to go about looking at tenure, and there's not. I mean, it's not like healthcare or something like that. And at those 100 institutions, we could do that. And I think the challenge of what Peter's saying is less about tenure and more about salaries. That, you know, at research universities, those in the natural sciences and the social sciences who bring in engineering, who bring in significant research money, are largely going to be paid better than those who are in the humanities. But in terms of getting tenure and then promotion, it's not necessarily dependent on that they bring in money. It's that they are judged by their peers, and their peers are other anthropologists or other medieval scholars, that they are top-notch in their field. And that may be that they've got a particular scholarship, like a Guggenheim or something, but it doesn't mean that they're competing against some guy who brought in $2 million from the National Science Foundation.
Really? You're saying that how much money you bring in has no bearing at all?
In terms of tenure and promotion, and again, I'm only talking about 100 universities
right.
in America, you know, it's fanciful. I mean, if we thought that a classicist needs to bring in $1 million, I would wager that there's no classicist in America who has brought in $1 million. Now, there's an overemphasis on, you know, the sciences in terms of us emphasizing that. But in terms of the individual candidate going up for tenure, especially the younger candidate, the guy who's an assistant professor and wants to become an associate, we're really not looking, by and large, for that. We're looking for what is the evidence that this person does top-notch research.
Mm-hmm. Peter Jeffrey, you've been involved in a lot of tenure decisions. What do you look at?
Well, it's certainly true at research universities. In the humanities, we look at how, you know, how is their research evaluated by other people in the field who presumably know what they're talking about. And so I've been asked to write letters about people, and I've been on committees that read the letters about people. I didn't mean to say that anybody who's going out for tenure in classics is being asked, why haven't you brought in $1 million? But I will say when the university decides what to prioritize, it does look at the fact that science brings in a lot more money than the humanities does, and that does help them make decisions about what kind of positions they can have and how many positions they can have and things of that nature. So, you know, but yeah, I think the big difference in terms of deciding who gets tenured is to how much attention is paid to teaching. And I do think that at places like Princeton, they do look at teaching, but they do look very much more at research. And as a professor on the committee within the department level, I was really only asked about research. I was rarely asked any questions about teaching.
Let's take more phone calls, and we'll do so momentarily. Our number is 800-486-8655. Justin, thanks very much for your call. From the sound of your voice, in just a few brief moments, it sounds like you're going to be a great teacher, I think. We'll take more calls momentarily. We have two guests with us this hour, and we're talking about tenure and if we need a three-track tenure system and what the problems may be with adjunct professors using graduate students to teach courses and getting the best teachers in front of the classroom, how we accomplish that. in higher education. Peter Jeffrey is professor of medieval studies at the University of Notre Dame. William Tierney, university professor, co-director of the Center for Higher Education at the University of Southern California, and past president of the Academic Educational Research Association. To you, more of you in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go back to phone calls, and Jim in New Berlin is next. Hi, Jim.
Hello. I normally don't sound this way when I'm not nervous, but anyway.
Don't be nervous. It's just us.
I call from the perspective of a holder of a master's degree in biomedical engineering, and I just called to talk about one professor that I had who had a big influence on my education, partly because he was my thesis advisor, but also because I took some of his classes, and he was a horrible teacher.
Why? What made him horrible, Jim?
Hard to put my finger on it. There was something about him that he just, I mean, maybe I shouldn't use the word horrible, but he didn't grab your attention at all. In fact, I remember one particular lecture where he was talking about, and I promise not to get too nerdy here, the electrical signals, tiny electrical signals that come out of muscles, and how those can be captured and analyzed, and once they are understood and interpreted, can be used used to command artificial limbs. And I fell asleep.
Oh my goodness!
And he concluded the lecture with, "And this is how we can make a paralyzed person able to use their limb again." And I woke up with a start, and my pen made a little mark on the paper. I mean, that's how much I jumped.
Right.
And I thought to myself, how could a guy give a lecture about such a fascinating topic? I mean, that should be a TED Talk, and put me to sleep.
And should that person be teaching, Professor Tierney?
No. I mean, the answer is no. As an undergraduate, I was an undergraduate at Tufts University in Boston. I majored in English. And I can, you know, although this was a million years ago, I can remember some phenomenal faculty I had. Dr. Ritchie taught a drama class that, you know, stays with me to this day. And I'm fairly involved at the University of Southern California. And I'm sure that there are some faculty like that everywhere and at USC. But I also know that my dean, monitors these situations every semester. And if Jim's comment was passed along and reflected in student evaluations, and it was not just one student, but, you know, the whole class was snoozing while the guy was lecturing, we would do something. And you can't, I mean, you know, again, in any organization, you can't let a situation the way Jim describes it just fester. It's ridiculous. And in a time when we look on things like a business, and if the student's a consumer, what a horrible message to say. I mean, thank God for the institution where Jim went that he didn't say that he was an undergraduate at Institution X, because it reflects so poorly. So those sorts of things are unconscionable. They got to change. And, I'm confident in my own institution that we wouldn't let that happen.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Jim, so much for your call. Let's give this one to you. It's an email, Professor Jeffrey, from Paul. He says federal legislation and the Department of Labor should be involved when a school is found to be employing multiple part-time instructors in lieu of fewer full-time instructors if they have enough work for full-time positions. If this is not outright illegal, we could at least diminish their ability to qualify for and receive government funding of various sorts.
Well, that's a complicated issue. I think a lot of businesses would say you don't want to have the government, education should be more like a business. You don't want to have the government telling you how to run your business. I don't know. Which part of the government would it be? I mean, the Consumer Protection Bureau or the Department of Education?
Department of Labor, he suggests.
Department of Labor, he says. Well, the way I see the Department of Labor is that it's usually about protecting the workers and, like, from unsafe conditions and things like that. And it seems like protecting the students from a bad teacher would not be a Department of Labor issue. I don't know. I can't see this. As a Department of Labor issue, I can't see this. Maybe as a Department of Education issue. But just like for-profit corporations, universities don't want to be, don't want to have a lot of government bureaucrats telling them what to do or how to spend their money or how to run their business.
Let's go to Fred in Madison. Hi, Fred.
Hi, Kathleen. Very good show. I just want to make 2 points. One is adjunct faculty. I was an adjunct for over 20 years. Sometimes they work with no pay, and here's how it works. But it's all dependent on enrollment. You're given a class, you teach the first section, you teach the second section, you teach 2 lectures, then the class is canceled, no contract is ever drawn up. And I bet your guests would say something about that, and no doubt they would say, awful, awful. And now here's my second point. I say abolish tenure. I say hire people for 3 or 5 or at most 8 years, because what it sets up is a kind of aristocracy, a kind of crown, and it's very much in unison with the hierarchical tendencies of the last 20, 30 years. The exalted are more exalted than ever, and then those in the abyss who receive the crumbs. I'm telling you the way it has been with me, and I'm out of the field now. I'm in retail, which has its own problems. But I would like your guest to comment on these 2 points. One,
yes,
work without pay. And two, the kind of House of Lords mentality
right.
of people who have tenure. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Fred. Thanks for your call. Professor Tierney.
The working without pay thing and tying it back also to what Peter just said, you know, we're seeing two issues emerge over time. One is that the working without pay, at least in a state like California, is right or wrong, and obviously it's wrong, is getting harder and harder to do because the Department of Labor is in the state is not going to allow that anymore. Even at a point when somebody's working 40% time, we want them to increase to 50% time so they get health benefits. And those are labor issues. The consumer protection part of this, you know, we haven't mentioned accreditation and we haven't mentioned for-profit higher education. But there has been such a brouhaha about the weakness of for-profit institutions, where, by the way, there are no tenure-track faculty. So if Fred wants to look at a place where, you know, everybody's the same, you could look at for-profits. And the problem, however, that many allege, is that the quality of teaching, because none of them do research, is abysmal. And where that lies increasingly is in consumer protection. That in California and other states, it's the Consumer Protection Agency that is looking out for the consumer, the student. And then quickly, just his last point in terms of getting rid of tenure, let me go back to my very first statement, and that's that tenure came about to protect academic freedom. So as with any policy, you can eliminate the policy, but if the good is still there, if you still think academic freedom is important, then what are we going to do to have that protected? Because you can't just say, oh, we support it. There has
right.
to be some, you know, structural thing that does it.
And history proves that we do need to protect it. Thank you both so much for being with us. Our thanks to William Tierney, university professor and at the Center for Higher Education at the University of Southern California, Peter Jeffrey, professor of medieval studies at the University of Notre Dame. Go to our Facebook page to get the article that prompted this whole discussion, and that's the Kathleen Dunn Show. Thanks to Marika Suval for producing this hour, and thanks to KP Whaley for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. News is coming up momentarily from National Public Radio, and then we talk about Abraham Lincoln on this, his birthday.